Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host and favorite mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And only mother, I hope.
I think so.
Yeah, well, we've had quite a time here in Iowa, and we're supposed to get warm over the weekend, and so we're looking forward to that.
We're coming out of the polar vortex.
Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting. It didn't seem as bad as I thought it was going to be. It didn't feel as bad as I thought it was going to be, because I did go outside every day of this extreme cold weather, not for very long, I'll admit. It's not very far from my house to the car, my car to the office. And I dressed extremely warmly, but I don't know. I just expected it to be worse, I think.
Well, your car started, so that was good.
My car started. My house is nice and warm. My office is nice and warm. I know I'm very yeah. fortunate that there are people who had trouble keeping their houses warm.
Yeah, that's right.
But
your pipes didn't freeze, so you're in good shape.
Exactly. Now, the characters in our book today faced some real hardship.
Oh my gosh!
And there were some times when they got pretty darn cold.
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah, and it's just amazing to me that they were able to do that. And I grew up, you know, I was a kid when the war was on, but I never heard of this thing, never heard of these people.
Well, who's our author today, Mom?
Okay, today our author is Jane Healy. Jane left a career in high tech to become a freelance writer. Her debut novel, The Saturday Evening Girls Club, was published in 2017. Based on the true story of a group of Jewish and Italian immigrant women in Boston's North End, the turn of the 20th century. Now, this book is really something. It continues to fulfill her dream of writing about lesser-known stories of women in American history. And these women are true heroes to me, because I can only imagine what our troops had to go through in the Second World War, in any war, and these girls brought a touch of home to them. And to me, that was just, they couldn't have brought anything greater than that.
And the title of the book is The Beantown Girls.
Yeah. I'd like to know why the Beantown.
And welcome to Writers' Voices, Jane.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today.
So, yeah, let's just start out. The Beantown, what's that mean?
So Beantown is an old nickname for the city of Boston, and the three main characters are from Boston. They're three friends that decide to become Red Cross Clubmobile girls in the European Theater of Operations. So that's where the name came from.
Okay.
And you live north of Boston with your husband.
I do.
Your husband, two daughters, two cats. Were you born and raised around there?
I was. I grew up in Arlington, which is right outside the city of Boston. It's a couple towns over. And my husband's from the Midwest, but I've lived here all my life.
You don't sound real Bostonish to me. I'm not getting the park the car.
Oh, well, you know what? Give me a couple glasses of wine and it might come back. my parents, it's very strong. My parents took care of my daughters a lot when they were younger, and then my daughters would come home and, like, all of a sudden they'd have this really strong Boston accent. My husband would be like, "What is going on?" You know? They're dropping their R's. Yeah.
So this book and your previous book both had characters from Boston.
Yes.
And you're telling, like I said, stories of American women in history that are not so well known. How did you find these stories?
Well, for my first book, I actually had written an article about the Saturday Evening Girls Club. The title of the book is Saturday Evening Girls Club, because their pottery has become highly collectible, actually. It's also called Paul Revere pottery. It's a iconic example of the arts and crafts movement. So that is how I stumbled onto their story, and ultimately ended up writing the novel. And for this one, I was really looking for another story of lesser known women in American history. And kind of was, my grandfather was a World War II vet. He was a firefighter on the Navy ships off the coast of Africa and Europe. And, I've always been interested in World War II history. So I kind of, you know, went after stories in World War II, and I stumbled upon a picture of these four women standing in a field, wearing uniforms I didn't really recognize. And underneath the picture, it said, you know, Red Cross Clubmobile Girls in Europe. I think the year was 1944. And I was so intrigued because I had never heard of them before. And that's how I ended up researching and ultimately writing this story.
Well, you said that that you were able to get firsthand accounts of what happened to them, to their writings. And how did you find those?
Yes, that was amazing. You know, I'm in Boston, and Harvard has the Schlesinger Library, and that has tons of archive materials related to American women's history. And so I had actually gone to them when I did my first novel, and I went on their website and was wondering if they had anything about these women. And they actually had 13 boxes of just amazing artifacts, amazing, like letters and diaries. They even have one of the uniforms. They had their ration cards and training manuals. It was incredible. And I had one of my friends come with me, and I had my daughter come with me one day, and we just went through all of these materials and took pictures and made copies, and it was incredible. And they were really prolific writers. There are some of the scenes described in the book are really taken from directly from my research, because these women were such beautiful writers and just captured the pictures, I mean, the settings and the things that they were going through so well.
You could tell that it was firsthand because, you know, it's just the way it was written.
Thank you. They were, I mean, it was just, I would be sitting there at the library going through this stuff and almost in tears sometimes, because their writing was so beautiful, and you just can't imagine some of the things that these women encountered. They were really, like you said, they were heroes in their own right in many ways.
What was the role of the Clubmobile Girls in the European Theater of Operation?
Yes, that's a great question. So the Clubmobile, it was started by the Red Cross. I'll back up a little bit. Harvey Gibson was the head of the Red Cross at the time during World War II. He was the head of the Red Cross in Europe. And I didn't realize how closely the military and the Red Cross worked. They really worked hand in hand. And the military, you know, leaders in the military came to Harvey Gibson and said, look, these clubs in the major cities are wonderful and helpful and offer a great source of support for our soldiers, but we need more in the field. We have all these men in the field in these far-flung places, and what can we do for them to make their jobs a little bit easier? And so he came up with the idea of Red Cross clubs on wheels, and they were essentially like modern-day food trucks. And they hired these women. It was a very selective process. They would hire three women from the U.S. They would go out to the field. They would go literally up to the front lines of the war and play music and serve coffee and donuts and hand out cigarettes and candy. And in many ways ended up being, you know, social workers and psychologists and huge sources of support for these men.
You know, what intrigued me was the choice of donuts.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that too. It didn't seem to be like the easiest thing in the world for these women to be making donuts out on the front lines.
On the front lines. I know. I'm like, I can't even believe what they had to go through to make these donuts. It was not easy. And they just like, and the machines broke all the time, and parts would freeze, and the lard would freeze, or, you know, all the different ingredients. And it was torture. And they eventually, towards the end of the war, realized like this whole like making of the donuts in the truck is not working. And they would outsource it to local bakeries or hire people to make them at a central site. But because, I mean, it was torture, you know, that was one thing to a person, like every woman I read, you know, every letter I read, every diary entry, they hated making those donuts in that truck. It was awful.
I mean, they could have done done cookies or something, you know, something
that
you
anything. Like, I you know, I think they had this whole idea of like, oh, what's really American? And it's like donuts and coffee. That is the, you know, that's a real taste of home. So, but they didn't, you know.
I see.
Yeah, yeah. So they were trying to do something that would like really, you know, but it, I mean, in theory, it sounds great. But then the actual like practice of it, having to make these on the fly in the middle of the war zone, it was not. Yeah, it wasn't good.
Now they were like you said, right on the front lines. They were in dangerous areas. It kind of surprises me that they were allowed to do that.
I was really surprised by that as well. They had more access to the front lines of the war than war correspondents and really a lot of soldiers. They were allowed to go literally up to or very near the front lines, all over Europe and other parts and Africa and Asia as well, which I thought was really, and, you know, and risk their lives to do this job.
And were there any casualties?
You know, there were. I was just putting together talking points for my library presentations, and I don't have an exact number. I know that there were at least two Red Cross Club girls killed in the war. One of them was in a bombing accident at a hospital. She was being treated, and another mm-hmm. one was flying in a small plane from England to Paris, and their plane crashed. I think it was around 13 Clomobiles in total that were killed during the war for, you know, various reasons. But I don't, you know, the number is kind of a moving target. I've seen different numbers.
Do you think the women realized how risky it was when they signed up?
No, I think so. I think they were, you know, a little naive. And I think a lot of them had, you know, I kind of hope to convey that in the book. They were tired of seeing all the, you know, friends and brothers and cousins and neighbors go to, all these men in their lives go to war. And they were, you know, they were able-bodied and they were smart and they were young and they wanted to do more than just stay at home. And so they saw this opportunity and they jumped on it. And I think some of them just really you can't really know what you're getting into, I think, until you're there with a situation like that often. So I think a lot of them were a little naive going into it, but just really wanted to serve their country in a meaningful way.
When you started working on this book, Jane, were there any of the Club Mobile girls still living that you could talk to?
You know, that's a great question. There's, you know, if anyone's interested, you can, if you Google or go on YouTube, Red Cross Club Mobile girls, there's some of the women are interviewed and later in their life, and it's great. There's some great interviews. They had to be over 25 1942 to 1945, so all of them would be in their mid to late 90s or older. So I did not interview any of them in person. I did recently just hear through someone sent me an article. One of them lives somewhere in the Midwest and just celebrated her 100th birthday. So I reached out to her hometown paper to try to get in touch with her, but I have not heard anything back yet.
Oh, wow. Well, I hope you're successful in connecting with her. That would be awesome.
Yes, I hope she'll
yes,
be,
me
I
too.
Hope she's able to read, yeah, I hope she's able to read this book, too, you know.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I would love that. I'd love to send her a copy.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jane Healy, author of The Beantown Girls, which is a story set in World War II of three women from Boston who became Red Cross Club Mobile girls in the European Theater of Operations, which they called the ETO. And they seem to have a lot of fun there, as well as working really hard. Did you find that in your research?
I really did. I think that, you know, a lot of them realized that they had to take the moments of fun when they could, and the soldiers appreciated that too, whether it was, you know, having an impromptu dinner party around a fire, or, you know, dancing in cow fields, dancing the jitterbug in cow fields, or going into London or Paris, you know, for an overnight stay. I think they understood what dangerous times they were in, and so they really try to enjoy it and live in the moment and enjoy those precious times when they could have fun.
I would expect that a lot of the girls, and this was certainly an issue for your characters, when they arrived there, weren't all that experienced as drivers, and certainly not of, you know, this would be what, a large van or a panel truck sized vehicle?
Yes, it was a large GMC truck. Yeah, that, you know, it, when it the program originally started, it was in 1942. They used British Green Line buses, but when they wanted to start sending the Clubmobiles over to France, they realized that the buses were not gonna work, you know, that close to the front line. So they trained these girls to drive these huge GMC trucks, and some of them really took to it. But a lot of these women were city girls and had never, you know, didn't have their license at home, had never driven a truck before, you know. So they were kind of thrown into it and, you know, had the really quick driving lessons over in the UK. And then they're like, okay, now you're on your way. You got to drive this truck into war, like, which is insane to me, you know.
I can't imagine that the roads would, in wartime, the roads would not be that good either.
Oh, terrible, terrible. And, you know, you think about, like, I made a map on Google to sort of track where they went in the war. But, you know, you think about, like, well, in modern day times, it might take you an hour to get between two cities. But back then, roads were closed, roads were bombed out, bridges had exploded, you know, so everything took longer.
Yeah.
And they had, what, 2 weeks of training before they started?
They had they generally had 6 weeks in D.C.
Okay. Then
really just a couple weeks in London for some of the more tactical things, like learning how to make the donuts and coffee on the fly and learning how to drive. You know, it seems kind of insane, but the Clubmobile program was so successful that they were just really training these girls as fast as they could to get them out into the field.
Wow. And of course, when they got to London, they were exposed to these buzz bombs. You want to explain what that was?
Yes. Yeah, so these were bombs that were coming from Germany. They were not manned. And they were coming over the city mostly at night, sometimes first thing in the morning. And so the girls had to get used to, these air raid drills, and they literally had to watch. They were all put on watch on the top of the roofs of, you know, on shifts on the top of the roofs of their dorms. And actually, in August of 1944, there was like the highest amount of buzz bombs came into the city. I think it was around August 1st. And that was, you know, when I have a chapter in the book where that's the night they decide they have to get out before things get too bad. But yeah, it was a constant. I mean, you think about what, you know, of course the U.S. suffered in the war, but you think about what these Londoners had to live with for years. It's just incredible to me what they went through.
So were they drones?
Yeah, they were kind of like drones. Yeah. They were, they were not manned, and they were coming, and they were getting more sophisticated. The Germans got more sophisticated with the technology over the course of the war. And they would just come into the city. You could hear it. That was like a quiet whistle, and they'd get louder as they got closer, and and just drop strategically all over London.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Now, if my memory serves me right, actually Hitler pretty much had England on its knees using those things, and then he for some reason decided to turn toward Russia, and that was his downfall, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank heavens for his email.
Exactly. Yeah. The buzz bombs devastated the city, and in one chapter in the book, there's warnings that they're coming in the morning because the Germans were trying to bomb the military officers as they were walking to work. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The constant danger they were under.
I guess you get used to it after a while, or maybe you don't. I'm not sure.
No, you know, in the letters and diaries I read, it's funny. I think it's funny what you do get used to, because one woman in particular, Liz Richardson, someone wrote a book compiling all of her letters and diary entries. And she said at first all these women were like, had the shakes and like, you know, were traumatized and couldn't get past the fact that they were being bombed all the time. And then a few weeks later, they were just shrugging their shoulders like, well, this is life. And, you know, we're just going to deal with it. Go down to the basement with their helmets on and then get back to work. So, yeah, it's amazing what you get used to, I think.
Wow. I was surprised that after the truce in Europe, then they said that they could go to the Pacific, you know, and the war over there. I was kind of surprised by that they were actually going to try this same thing over there.
Yes, and they did send women over there. And I was surprised by that, too, because I was like, well, you know, these women had served, you know, a pretty dangerous role for almost a year, but they had the option to move on or to go to Germany or to go home. But some of them served, you know, they were in India, they were in Burma, the Club Mobile girls were, you know, all over Europe and other parts of the world during the war.
Wow. It's just so amazing to me. It just really is.
It is.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've heard so little about it, too.
Yeah,
amazing.
Right. I mean, I never heard about this.
That's what really intrigued me and, to be honest, kind of bothered me. I'm like, these women were incredible. How can their stories have been left behind by history in this way? You know, they really, you know, as, you know, they were honored a few years ago. There was some sort of declaration in Congress, and one of the senators there said, you know, it shows you that, you know, there weren't just males at the front, you know, men at the front lines of the war in World War II in Europe. There were women there too. And they were the Club Mobile girls, you know, and it's just incredible that they've kind of been forgotten in that way.
And they were unarmed.
No, unarmed. Yeah. You know, a few of them, you know, one thing that, you know, I didn't include in the book is some of them did learn how to shoot. Some of the, you know, they would get lessons from some of the soldiers and they'd learn how, just because they were so close to the front lines, the soldiers were like, you might as well learn how to do this just in case, you know, for your own safety. But none of them really took to it. They weren't really thrilled with the idea, but some of them did learn how to shoot.
Wow. You know, when back in the day, because I can remember we used to, of course, movies, there was no TV, so you went to movies, and there was always a newsreel, and it showed what was going on, you know, in Europe and in the Pacific and so forth, but they never showed this, and that's interesting to me.
Yeah, you know, there were some newsreels to recruit women, but I think later in the war, they really ramped up the recruitment the last couple of years of the war, and it was a really prestigious assignment. I mentioned in the novel that, you know, one of the the three friends discovered the Club Mobile girls, but when they went to the movies and saw a newsreel about them, but I think that was later when they were really desperate to find women to go over there, and so they stepped up and had a really aggressive recruiting campaign all over the country.
Now, your characters did, in the book, were in Life magazine. Was that, they were actually on the cover of Life magazine. Was that true to life?
They were featured in Life magazine at one point, but they were not on the cover. The cover, I made that part up. That was fictionalized. But they were, there was a feature about a group of them in February of, I think it was February of 1944, I want to say.
Uh-huh. Now, the characters are a trio of best friends that go from Boston to Europe, and they meet up with other trios of people not necessarily from the same backgrounds. Some of them maybe were put together by the Red Cross. But do you have a trio of best friends? Is this something that, you know, you have experience with in your life?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't have a trio of best friends, but I do have a group of high school friends that I've known since I was 13 years old or younger, and we all are still in touch. Some of us are scattered in different parts of the country, but the ones that are in the Boston area, we still try to get together at least a few times a year. There's, you know, a half dozen of us that are still close. So I think women's friendships are so important, you know, in life, and my Arlington girls, who I grew up with, my A-Town girls, as I call them, you know, are really important to me.
Well, Caroline, you've stayed close with friends from high school, and you're, you know, in your ninth decade of life, right?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's right. No, that's true. I still, you know, I still with kids.
Amazing.
That I grew up, kids that I grew up with, girls that I grew up with in grade school, and yeah, it's great.
And you don't know, you always think of them as girls still, like, even though, you know, I always call them my girls.
You know? Yeah, I know. I know. You know, and when we talk and we get together, it's like we have never been apart. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. You just pick up.
Yeah.
It is the beauty of it. They get you so well. They understand you so well. You just pick up where you left off, like, even if it's months or even years.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I don't really have that because of moving when I was about, like, just turning 14. So the kids that I grew up with and I didn't really see after that because we moved across country. And and the kids where we moved to a small town here in Iowa, and they'd all grown up together. So I was always a little bit of an outsider. And
oh, okay.
Yeah. So I don't have that, but I do have close women friends that I've met along the way. And some of them we go back 30 years or more. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jane Healy, the author of The Beantown Girls. Jane, would you like to read a little bit from the opening of the book?
Yes, I would love to. Thank you very much. Okay, so Chapter 1, July 14th, 1944, New York City. Dottie Vim and I stood together on the deck of the Queen Elizabeth, surrounded by a couple dozen other Red Cross workers and hundreds of U.S. soldiers. The once glamorous cruise ship, now painted a bland battleship gray for its current role as troop transporter, was making its final preparations for a departure to Europe. The three of us were enjoying the festive atmosphere as the people on the dock below waved up at the passengers, shouting their final farewells to loved ones on board. We had said our goodbyes to our families in Boston 6 weeks ago, but we waved and smiled at the strangers wishing us well. "I have to say, we all look pretty smart in these new uniforms," Dottie said, adjusting her light blue Red Cross cap and nodding at Viv and me with approval. "Fiona, the color brings out the gray in your eyes." "Thanks, Dottie," I said. "I agree. They aren't too bad." "Not too bad, except for these sensible black shoes they recommend that we buy," said Viv, looking down with a sour face. "They're horrible. Zero fashion. But yes, the uniforms are surprisingly spiffy." "Sweetheart, you all look better than spiffy," a soldier next to us said, staring at Dottie as he gave a whistle. His two friends nodded in agreement. They had to be fresh out of high school. So many of these newly minted GIs looked like they were playing dress-up in their father's uniforms. Still, Dottie flushed a deep shade of pink and turned away. "Oh, God, for God's sakes, Dottie, at least say thank you," Viv whispered to her with a nudge. "She thanks you, honey," Viv said to the soldier with a smile, and now he was the one blushing. "She's right," I said. "That's definitely not the last compliment you're going to get from a soldier. You better get used to it." Dottie was about to reply, but an army band on the docks below struck up a raucous rendition of Over There, and a rowdy group on the other side of us started singing along so loudly that it was difficult to talk over the noise. I looked up at the decks above ours as the hundreds of men pressed against railings like we were, waving goodbye to the crowds. Jostling and laughing with each other, they were all hiding their nerves beneath the bravado. And that's when I spotted my fiancé, Second Lieutenant Danny Barker, among the men on the deck above ours. My arms broke out in goose pimples despite the heat, and I felt a little faint. Tall and blonde, he looked incredibly handsome in his U.S. Army Air Force uniform. He was smiling and waving at the crowds below, too, and it was all I could do not to scream his name and go running upstairs to him. I wanted to do it so badly my heart ached. But I held back calling to him because deep down I knew it wasn't him. It couldn't be. Danny Barker had been declared missing in action more than 8 months ago, shot down in the skies over Germany. The ship's horn blasted our departure from the dock, and more soldiers joined in the singing. Dottie and Viv didn't notice me gripping the rail of the ship with white knuckles as I tried to tether myself to reality. I was desperate to quell the feeling of panic that was bubbling up inside of me. I shook up my head back and forth, blinking a few times. When I looked up again, I realized that the soldier I could have sworn was Danny bore only a passing resemblance to him. He was tall and blonde like Danny, but with sharp, angular features that were nothing like my fiancé's. It was a hot July day in New York City, and the ocean air was tainted with the smell of diesel, cigarettes, and cheap cologne. I don't know if it was the humidity that made the atmosphere feel heavy or the emotions of the hundreds of soldiers on the ship with us, jumping up and down, yelling their final goodbyes before heading off to war. Some of the women in the crowds below had started to cry, clutching their handkerchiefs and straining to capture these last glimpses of their beloved sons, brothers, and sweethearts so that they could remember them in the months to come. I felt grief in the pit of my stomach, grief that I had managed to push down for the past few months. But now we were bound for Europe. It all came back. Now that we were bound for Europe, it all came bubbling to the surface. Oh, God, I thought, what if this whole thing is an enormous mistake? I felt my face flush, and I thought I might throw up. I tugged on Dottie's arm. Viv was charming some of the men standing next to us with a story about learning to play ping pong during our recent training in D.C. I've got to find a bathroom, I said into Dottie's ear. I'm feeling a little ill. Sheesh, it's kind of early to be seasick, Fiona, Dottie said. We haven't even left the harbor yet. Fiona? Fiona! Dottie called after me as I moved as fast as I could through the throngs of GIs, my hand over my mouth. I heard greetings of, hey, doll, and what's the matter, Freckles, from the dozens of men I pushed past. A couple of them graciously asked if I was okay. I finally found a bathroom tucked into the space underneath the stairs to an upper deck. I slammed the door behind me and locked it, taking another deep breath as I splashed water on my face. In the small round mirror, I looked even paler than usual, making the freckles across my nose more prominent. I adjusted the pins on my new cap and smoothed down my newly shorn shoulder-length hair. It was only then that I noticed my hands were shaking. I opened the tiny porthole above the toilet to let in some air and sank to the floor. I didn't throw up, but for the first time in many months, I began to cry. In March, I had let Viv and Dottie drag me to see the Saturday matinee of Jane Eyre starring Orson Welles and Joan Fontaine. It had always been one of my favorite novels, so I reluctantly agreed to go. Before the movie started, we watched a short newsreel. The words, "Now more than ever, your Red Cross is at his side," flashed across the screen with a familiar picture of a soldier standing next to a woman in a Red Cross uniform, the same one I was wearing today. It was followed by footage of Red Cross Clubmobile girls serving the troops all over Europe. There was a trio of these girls in Italy, and then more footage of them in North Africa, happily serving coffee and donuts to soldiers out of a converted truck. There were other scenes of these women playing records and dancing the jitterbug with GIs against the backdrop of blown-out buildings. A voiceover began. Our Red Cross Clubmobile girls must be single college graduates and over the age of 25. They are handpicked for their looks, education, and personality. They are hardy physically and have a sociable, friendly manner. Seeing those women traveling, directly helping the war effort, had stirred something in me that I hadn't felt since Danny had gone missing. It was a combination of hope and exhilaration, that feeling you have before the first day of college or when starting a new job. The newsreel seemed like a sign from above. Maybe I could do something real in the war effort, other than assemble care packages at the local USO. Volunteering for the Red Cross could be a way to honor Danny. And more than anything, it was a plan, a way forward, a way to try to find out what had happened to him the day his plane was shot down. Right after seeing that reel, I decided to apply to become a Red Cross Clubmobile girl. I got up, looked at myself in the mirror, and said out loud to my reflection, "Nice job, Fiona. Did you think these soldiers wouldn't remind you of your missing fiancé? Did you think going to war was going to be a walk in the park? Get a grip." And that's my excerpt.
Yeah.
And that was Jane Healy reading from The Beantown Girls, and you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. So, Jane, your bio says you left a career in high tech to become a freelance writer.
Yes.
Did you always want to write? How exactly did that happen?
You know, I had always wanted to write. I always aspired to write fiction, always loved writing. But I was in high tech as a product manager. It was a job I enjoyed. But when my daughters were born, my husband and I were both in high tech. We were both working really long days. And I just wanted to find a work that was more family friendly. And that's how I ended up getting into freelance writing. You know, and I've worked on with private clients, and I've worked in journalism at various magazines and newspapers. So yeah, that's how I got into that. And then the fiction, I've really just been working on the side for a number of years. And then almost two years ago, the Saturday Evening Girls Club was published. And then the Beantown Girls is coming out this Tuesday. Wow. February 5th.
February 5th, 2019. So
yes.
How did, you know, so your first book, the Saturday Evening Girls Club, how did you get that published?
I didn't go about it the way a lot of writers do. I kind of did it a little bit differently. I put it on the shelf for about 5 years and then decided, you know, took it out and took a look at it a couple of years ago and decided I still love the story. And I was going to start submitting to agents again, like I had five years prior. And as I was putting together that list, I saw a contest called Kindle Scout online. And it's actually a crowdsourced publishing contest, and people vote for whether they think your book should be published or not. And so I put it up there, and you know, I tell this story a lot. I put it up there and also started querying agents. If you win Kindle Scout, you get an ebook deal. But I still wanted, you know, the real publishing deal. But I was like, you know, what do I have to lose? This manuscript has been sitting around my laptop for years. So I put it up there as I was trying to reach out to agents. And one of the reasons I put it on Kindle Scout is because I knew that editors and agents looked at that site at the time. The contest is no longer, but they looked at the site at the time to find potential projects. And I said to my husband when I put it up, the night I put it up on Kindle Scout, I said, I'm really just doing this because I want Danielle Marshall of Lake Union Publishing to call me up and offer to publish the Saturday Evening Girls Club. And we both had a laugh about it because we're like, that will never happen. And then, you know, I won Kindle Scout, which a lot of, you know, I wasn't the only winner. They pick a lot of winners. But then a week later, Danielle Marshall from Lake Union Publishing called me and offered me a publishing contract, and my head just about exploded, I'll be honest. So,
and why had you wanted that publisher in particular?
Because I, you know, as you do nowadays, I looked her up online and learned all about Lake Union, and I thought they would be a perfect fit because they publish women's fiction, book club fiction, and historical fiction. And I admired some of the books they had published. So I just thought, you know, I think this is the publisher for me. And I've since signed with an agent, Mark Gottlieb at Trident Media, and you know, done the whole agent thing. But I went about it, you know, kind of backwards.
Well, do you feel like you got really lucky?
I think it, you know. I think also, you know, I think timing is everything in publishing. I think that, you know, 5 years ago when I first tried to publish the Saturday Evening Girls Club, there wasn't an interest in immigrant fiction, American immigrant fiction. And then I felt like that, you know, books like Orphan Train and Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. And, you know, there's been a lot of great books, immigrant fiction books. And I felt like the market was better. So I think it was luck. I think it was timing, and I think it was, the book was ready for prime time.
Exactly. And Lake Union Publishing is affiliated with Amazon, correct?
It is. Amazon has 12 imprints that work like traditional publishing houses, and Lake Union is one of them.
So with the Beantown Girls, of course, it's a World War II book. I was talking with some friends about what we were reading recently, and the comment came up that it seemed like there's more World War II fiction published than anything else, but we all love it. So it's not, we aren't complaining about that, but do you see a lot of this, and what do you think it is about that era that attracts writers and readers?
I think there's it's certainly a trend in historical fiction right now. I think there's a lot of World War II fiction out there. I have a couple theories. One is, I think people love reading about that era. I think the 40s and the history of that war. I also think it's all because most of us still have some sort of personal personal connection to that war. You know, for me, it's my grandfather. And so I've always been kind of fascinated and intrigued. He was very heroic. He went over there. He fought on the, you know, a firefighter on the Navy ships, but he was so humble and never talked about it. And I've heard that over and over. That generation, a lot of them just wanted to put it aside, compartmentalize it, and put those memories away for good. And so that's why I think the mystery of it and the personal connection, and the fact that, you know, we all have family or friends or people we know who are somehow connected to that war. I think that's why there's such an interest in it.
And also, it seems like there's a lot of stories that have yet to be told.
Yes, I would definitely agree. There's a lot of stories, you know, particularly women's stories, because, you know, as we know, sometimes women's stories in history don't get the attention they deserve. And I think that's very, very true about these women during wartime. There's definitely more of an interest now than there was in years past.
Well, you know, the thing was, too, that the whole country was supportive of our troops. There was not the dissension that there is sometimes now and that there was after, for instance, the Vietnam War. You know, that was a horrible time there when the troops came home. So it was, but we were all pushing for the same goal. You know, we had food rationing, we had all this and that, but it, you know, nobody, I didn't hear too much complaint about it really when I was a kid.
Exactly. You know, yes. And that was one thing that was very clear to me in my research. There wasn't the dissension that there is now or there has been in other wars in American history. It's been, you know, it was very much of like, we're all in this together and we're all going to do what we can to support this effort. And we all believe in the cause, fiercely, you know?
Right.
Although I think prior to Pearl Harbor, there was a lot of conflict internally about whether we should get involved in the war or not. But
yes.
Once we were bombed, I think even people who maybe were pacifists decided that they just weren't going to say anything at that point. I don't think there was a lot of dissension after that. But I could be wrong. There might have been more than I realized, but that's something that people don't like to talk about.
No, I think you're right. I think prior to Pearl Harbor, there was, you know, people were conflicted, and then, you know, Pearl Harbor was something that everyone felt pretty passionately about, you know, getting behind the war effort after that.
Now, Jane, The Beantown Girls is also a romance. There's a lot of romantic aspect to it. Is this something that that you always put in your books, in your novels?
It's only my second novel, but I thought that certainly romantic elements for sure is something that I like to include. And I think that it was an interesting, you know, there's a lot of interesting love stories, obviously, in the war, and I read about a lot of them, and some of the different scenarios you read about in the book or in terms of romance are based on true stories. So, yeah, definitely. You know, I think it's fun. I think that, you know, it was a hard time, and these women experienced a lot of hardship, but I wanted to have some hopeful, heartwarming moments as well.
I would imagine, you know, being the only American women that some of those men see in months, probably.
Yes.
That they got a lot of attention.
Oh, like attention. So much attention. And they were like, and there was actually, they were given talks on how to sort of deflect a lot of that attention in a polite way. But I think one of the reasons they were, you know, the age requirement was 25 or older. Was because a lot of the soldiers that these girls worked with were 18 or 19 years old. So I think the age difference was actually beneficial because there was less likelihood of romance among, you know, the troops and the women.
Right.
More likely with other officers who were around the same age, but not so much with, you know, the troops who were, you know, a lot of times really just out of high school.
That makes sense.
No,
it was interesting
too that Viv, for instance, could use all these girls could use their their special talents. Of course, Dottie and her musical talent, but Viv and her artistic talent, drawing, making drawings of these soldiers that they could send home. You know, that's the kind of thing that, did that really happen?
That really did happen. Definitely. You know, some of these women were hired for their musical talents, musical abilities. But I was really intrigued by one story I read with this woman who was very artistic and started drawing portraits and pictures for these soldiers to send home. And I thought, that's amazing that she had. And it wasn't like the Red Cross hired her specifically to do that, but she just found that niche. And it gave the soldiers, you know, so much happiness that she ended up, they formalized it as a real job for her.
Yeah, gosh, that's one of the amazing things about this whole situation, that something like that could come out of that.
Really remarkable.
Yeah. Now, speaking of music, there's an episode in the book in England with the Glenn Miller Orchestra. Is that based on something that actually happened?
Yes, and I had that's one of my favorite scenes in the book. So so thank you for bringing that up, because one thing that I learned in my research is that Glenn Miller and his military orchestra, military band, would actually perform these secret concerts for the troops out in the field. They were top secret, for obvious reasons, and he went all over the European theater performing for the troops, and often the troops or the Red Cross didn't even know who was performing until minutes before the concert, because they wanted to keep it under wraps. So that is based on a true story that he did perform in Leicester, England, at the hall there, De Mantfort Hall, for troops and for Red Cross women, and some of the women were there. Said it was one of the most amazing nights, of their lives. It was really incredible.
Yeah.
Now, everyone's heard of Glenn Miller, at least everyone my generation and older, but I don't know much about him. I did not know that he was in the war or what happened to him.
I didn't know. I love his music. But I didn't know that much about him either. And he was, he was incredibly involved in the war effort and in the, in supporting the troops in that way and going, and he had a radio show over there. And then he'd perform all over the place. I didn't know that he had done that. I didn't know about the secret concerts. And then I didn't know that his plane actually went missing, when he was heading for a concert in Paris, and that's still one of those unsolved mysteries of the war that people still talk about. Like, is he really missing? Did he end up somewhere? I think there was just recently another article about they think they finally found his plane in the English Channel, which, I think people still want those answers because he was such a beloved, figure, such a beloved musician.
No, there's a movie, The Glenn Miller Story, which he really should try to get a hold of sometime, because it's a really good movie. It's all about that, about his life and when he died.
Oh, it's so funny you mentioned that. Someone on Facebook we were just talking about Glenn Miller and the book, and she said you really have to see that movie, and I haven't seen it yet. So, like, I think it's freezing here in Boston this weekend too, so I think I might have to watch that tonight by the fire.
Well, we're gonna have warm weather this weekend. We went through 20 below 2 days ago, and it's supposed to be up in the mid 50s tomorrow.
Crazy. The extremes. Yeah, we're about 4 degrees right now. I guess by Sunday or Monday it's going to turn warm up again, but not as bad as you guys. Girls have had it tough.
Yep. Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jane Healy, author of The Beantown Girls. So Jane, tell us a little bit about your writing process. Do you have a fairly fleshed out idea of the storyline at the beginning, or does that come as you write about the characters?
I am definitely a planner and an outliner. So, with this story, and there's, I have so much research as a historical fiction writer. I really like to keep my research organized. So for this story, I really mapped out the entire book chapter by chapter, scene by scene, also pulling in what research I needed. And that's not to say that things didn't change along the way. If I felt like something didn't feel organic or authentic to the story, then I would, go in a different direction. But I like to have a map before I get started. It just helps me think about things more clearly and, sort of get a big picture, beginning, middle, end, of how everything works.
When you came up with the idea to write about the Red Cross Clubmobile girls, did you first go for developing the characters and figure out who you're going to put in this story, or did you just dive into the research and then the characters came out of the research, or how did that work?
I really, I dove into the research, I think, and the characters, they really did. They form, the characters came out of the research. I really threw myself into the research, and when I felt like I had a solid base of research and understanding of the time and the place and the women and what they had gone through, I created these characters that were really composites of the different women I had read about. You mentioned Dottie is an artist, and one of the women I read about, was this amazing artist, and I thought that was such an interesting storyline, and I wanted to somehow pull that into the novel. So that's how Dottie came to be. And there's another minor character, Frankie, who is a widow and decides to join the Clubmobile girls because she's a widow and feels lost about her future. And that is actually based on another true story. So that's really, I think the characters come out of the research in different ways.
Did you go to England, go to Europe in order to write the scenes that are set there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had been to, I didn't specifically go on research trips. I have been to almost all of the places in the book except for Belgium. And I considered going there, but I was on deadline and I just didn't know if I'd have enough time to take that trip. And so I really relied on, a lot of historical pictures and documents and maps and accounts of the war, not just from the Clubmobile girls' perspective, but from the soldiers who fought at the Battle of the Bulge. I really immersed myself in that history and the terrain of the Ardennes Forest and the towns there and what they went through. But to answer your question, I've been to almost every place in the book except for Belgium.
Wow. When the girls are in Europe and it's after D-Day, and when they meet soldiers and ask them how long they've been there, how do they answer?
After they always answer. I thought this was another interesting fact I didn't know about. The soldiers would always answer D plus 10 or D plus 100, and it was always D-Day plus how many days they had been there. That's what the D stood for, which I thought that was an interesting way to think about your life and the time spent at war. But yeah, that was part of the language.
Of course, of the war. Anyone who came there who for D-Day would have been there. They're all there the same time. Then everybody would be there D plus 100 or D plus 100.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And towards the end of the story where she's making a decision of where to go after the European, war, obviously it's not a spoiler. We know how the war ended, how the war in Europe ended, but it was still going on in the Pacific. And so, like Mom said, the girls had an option to go there or to actually stay with the Red Cross in other doing other things. So what were some of the things that some of these women chose to do after they were done in Europe?
Some of them would work at, the Clubmobile program continued a little bit after 1945 into 1946. So some of them remained with the Clubmobile efforts, and some of them went to work at some of the clubs in the major cities. Some of them helped with the liberation of POWs. That was a huge undertaking for the Red Cross and the military. So many of them were involved in those efforts for some time. you know, so there was a lot of different options. Some of them were more than ready to go home, but some of them decided to stay on and, you know, fell in love with the lifestyle and the travel and sort of the, I think the adrenaline of working in that environment. Some of them really became, you know, addicted to it and loved that lifestyle, that nomadic lifestyle, and weren't ready to go back to normal civilian life yet. And so they stayed on for longer.
Was the Red Cross involved in helping handle the survivors of the concentration camps and so forth as well?
You know, they were, but I didn't read about the Clubmobile girls being involved in that effort much at all. Like a couple of them who were the ones that ended up in Germany towards the end of the war did end up seeing the camps. More than a few were warned not to go see the camps by soldiers. But yeah, some of them caught wind of what had happened and what the camps were, but none of them, as far as I know, worked in the camp, with the liberation of the concentration camps. A lot of them were involved in the liberation of POWs as they started to come back, but not as much with the concentration camps.
Well, I bet there's lots of stories still to be told about the liberation of POWs and that effort too. But Jane, do you have, you don't have to tell us what it is, but do you have what your next historical novel will be?
Do you know? You know, I'm working on, thank you for asking. I've started working on the research and it's still very kind of in the ether right now. So I'm not going to talk too much about it, but it's another, you know, lesser known story of women during wartime. I didn't plan on writing another story of women during wartime, but this one I kind of discovered and haven't been able to let go of. So
okay.
I'll let you know when I have something more substantive to tell about it.
And about how long does it take you to finish one of these books?
This last one, the first one, the Saturday Evening Girls Club, I worked on, you know, very part-time basis over a number of years, so it's hard to gauge. But this last one, you know, about a year and a half, including the research, almost 2 years probably.
Well, I can see you've got why, because there's a lot in here. And
Thank you. Speaking
of time, we're about out of time. Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
I do. I mean, there are a lot of quotes that I found, but this one, because they brought kindness to these soldiers, and the smallest act of kindness is worth more than the grandest intentions.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, and they did. That's what they did. They brought kindness, not just donuts.
They really did.
Yeah.
They were at the comforts of home, but also just humanity and kindness to these soldiers at a time when they desperately just needed that, you know, whether it was a shoulder to cry on or, you know, a cup of coffee and a joke or listening to some Glenn Miller, or, you know, they filled a need that was really important.
Well, Jane, thank you for bringing this story to light.
Thank
you for being with us today on Writers' Voices.
And thank you for having me. It was wonderful to talk to you both. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.